This Marketplace podcast is supported by Invest Puerto Rico. What's next in innovation? That's not the right question. It's where. Puerto Rico, more than just a tropical paradise, it's innovation's paradise, where startups and global players coexist in a vast and vibrant ecosystem, where talent runs deep, highly skilled, and bilingual. Plus, the island offers the most competitive tax incentives in the U.S. If you believe your business can go anywhere, Puerto Rico is the place. Find out more at investpr.org/marketplace. Again, that address is investpr.org/marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments, celebrating over 70 years of service to financial advisors, their clients, and institutions worldwide. Putnam Investments, a world of investing. Produced in association with the University of Southern California.
It's notoriously difficult to predict the top or the bottom of any particular market, but a lot of people are saying this about housing now. We are not at the bottom yet. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Progressive Insurance with Snapshot, a program in which rates are determined by the driving habits of policyholders. Learn more at progressive.com. Coverage of the economy is supported in part by the Schuman Center for Media and Democracy.
From the Frank Stanton Studios in Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. It's Monday today, the 9th of May. Good to have you with us. Spring is the traditional home buying season, right? Well, sadly, a lot of people seem not to have been told, and those people were home buyers the past couple of years. A gloomy report out today isn't doing the American housing market any favors. The real estate website Zillow.com says that in the first 3 months of the year, home values had their sharpest drop since the worst of the housing recession back in 2008. Worse, with prices still dropping long after a lot of people said they'd start bouncing back, predictions of the long-awaited housing bottom are anybody's guess. Marketplace's Janet Babin reports.
The Zillow report comes as no surprise to real estate agent Ed Canary in Seattle. His business is off 40% from last year, and he knows what's holding his sales back.
People with relatively good credit still having trouble getting financing. And people still being a little gun-shy, a little wary of getting back in the market because they're not sure if it is bottomed out.
Many economists thought that bottom would come sometime this year, but now Zillow and others have revised their forecasts and believe prices will keep falling until at least 2012, in part because of a glut of foreclosed homes. Jonathan Miller is president of Miller Samuel Real Estate Appraisers in New York.
Foreclosures are probably peaking this year. That only means we're about halfway. We still have 4 to 5 more years of above-trend foreclosure activity.
Many of those foreclosed properties sell at discounts that drag down home prices even further. And foreclosed homes still on bank books serve as a grim reminder of all the lending mistakes they made. Duke University economics professor Jacob Vigdor says that's made banks afraid of their own shadow.
A lot of lending institutions out there got burned pretty badly. Because of that, they are really scaling back, and they're looking more carefully at people's credit records and asking for a bigger down payment.
On top of conservative banks and shy buyers, the next hurdle for the housing market could be higher interest rates. I'm Janet Babin for Marketplace.
Memphis, Tennessee is bracing for the worst from the surging Mississippi River. The crest is expected to hit Memphis sometime tonight and then roll on downstream toward New Orleans. By the time all is said and done, flood losses along the river may be the worst since Hurricane Katrina in 2005. All you have to do is look in the mirror if you want to know who's picking up the tab. From Washington, Marketplace's Scott Tong reports.
Normally in Memphis, the Mississippi River spans half a mile wide. Now, it's 3 miles. Virgil Bailey volunteers at an emergency shelter at Cummings Street Baptist Church.
There are some homes that are covered completely, rooftop and everything, covered. You can't even tell that there was a house there.
The worst flooding since the 1920s will cost billions, and many people have no flood insurance. For them, the federal government tends to swoop in and declare emergency disaster zones. Tennessee's Emergency Management Agency is already asking for federal help, says spokesman Dean Fleener.
That declaration will provide assistance for uninsured homeowners who experience damage who would qualify for that individual assistance, and that would help them with repairs on their homes.
Not much help. Grants top out at $30,000, typically what a mere 6 inches of water does in damage. Flood insurance pays out a lot more, but only 5% of Americans choose to buy it. And there are problems there, too. Robert Hardwig at the Insurance Information Institute says flood premiums are vastly underpriced. They don't send a signal that, hey, living by water is risky.
The problem with respect to flooding is that that signal is not strong enough. The signal is deliberately muted by the flood insurance program on the direction of Congress.
Artificially cheap insurance means premiums don't bring in enough for payouts. So the difference, you guessed it, comes from federal borrowing and a bigger national debt load. In Washington, I'm Scott Tong for Marketplace.
Oil and gas prices came screaming back today. Floodwaters heading toward refineries along the Mississippi, down near New Orleans, apparently. Stocks edged up about 0.5%. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. Problems the Japanese power grid has been having since the earthquake and tsunami, power shortages mostly, could get worse because today one of the country's big energy companies said it's going to take 3 nuclear reactors offline while it builds better defenses against tsunamis. This week sometime, the Japanese government is expected to release a plan for compensating victims of the Fukushima disaster, but there is little agreement on who, other than taxpayers, ought to help foot that bill. The company that owns the plant, TEPCO, says it can't. Curtis Millhaupt is an expert in Japanese law at Columbia Law School. Curtis, welcome to the program.
Thank you very much.
Seems to me we ought to start with Japanese law and what it says about TEPCO's liability here.
All right. Well, Japan has a Nuclear Damage Compensation Act, which provides for unlimited liability for the operator of a nuclear plant. But there is an exception where the damage has been caused by, quote, a grave natural disaster of an exceptional character, end quote. Now, TEPCO seems to have quite a strong argument that the exception applies here and that they would not be liable. But from the early days of the crisis, the Japanese government has taken a very hard line on TEPCO's liability. They've said repeatedly that the exception does not apply. And just last week, Chief Cabinet Secretary Yukio Edano reiterated that point and said there would be no cap on damages. So TEPCO seems to be out of luck on that argument. Of course, they could try to litigate the point, but I think that's very unlikely.
There is talk over there in the Japanese legislature of just, in essence, nationalizing TEPCO, wiping out the shareholders, firing all the executives, and doing what has been done here with General Motors and forcing it into bankruptcy, that kind of thing. I mean, do you see that happening at all?
I think nationalization of TEPCO is extremely unlikely. It's not obvious what bringing TEPCO under government control would accomplish. The reactors at Fukushima need to be shut down permanently, and TEPCO needs to find a way to pay tens of billions of dollars in damages. I think what's much more likely is capital injections by the Japanese government and possibly coupled with some sort of management restructuring or some additional or new form of government oversight.
Where, though, would the Japanese government get this capital to inject? Because they have an enormous debt load. They're already talking about tax increases to pay for some of the cleanup and some of the other things. I mean, where are they going to get the money?
Well, governments have the ability to print money, and I think the reality is that the Japanese government deficit will simply be increased to cover these costs. I think ultimately TEPCO is too big to fail in the same way that some of the U.S. financial institutions were deemed to be too big to fail. And so the Japanese taxpayer is on the hook for this disaster.
You know, since we're talking about the financial crisis and the parallels, let me ask you this question then. We are still learning over here. Some would say we have not learned well enough the lessons of our financial crisis. Will anything change over there in terms of their power grid and these enormous power generating companies so that the next time something happens in a country that sits on an enormous fault zone, there will be a different outcome?
Well, I would like to say that the answer is yes, but I'm skeptical. The Japanese government has stated very forcefully that nuclear power will remain a very important part of Japan's power policy. I think the problem in Japan, as in the financial crisis, is poor corporate governance and lax government oversight. TEPCO has a 10 or more year history of safety problems and of covering up those safety problems. And so it makes one skeptical that there will be a complete new change of regime now, although the scope of this disaster is such that it may bring about changes.
Curtis Millhaupt is a professor of law at Columbia Law School. He's also an expert on the Japanese legal system. Professor, thanks a lot.
Thank you for having me.
Here's a twist on the state budget cut story we've all heard and read so many times over the past couple of years. About a month and a half ago, the New Hampshire House voted to cut $650 million from the budget, about 13% of all state spending. The debate moves to the Senate now, where advocates for various programs are lobbying and negotiating to save their slice of the pie. So far, pretty straightforward. The part we don't hear so often, though, is how lawmakers actually decide where the budget acts ought to fall. New Hampshire Public Radio's Dan Gorenstein has that story.
Time is at a premium right now for Republican Senate President Peter Bragdon. He's one of seven senators on the Finance Committee, and he's hearing from people hoping to restore cuts the House made, whether from lobbyists.
There are some things that have caused us all a great amount of concern, and we'd like to share that with you and some thoughts about how it might be different.
In committee hearings.
We are here to make the case for the university system.
Or meeting with constituents.
Hi. Peter Bragdon.
Nice to meet you.
I'm Brian Manfred.
Brian. Kathy. Good to meet you folks. Come on in.
The Manfreds have come to make the case against budget cuts for the developmentally disabled.
We are here on behalf of our daughter, Emily, who will be turning 21 in November. She is born with autism.
Okay.
If there's no funding for her, we're concerned about the options that are left to us and to her.
New Hampshire faces an estimated $700 million deficit. And last fall, Republicans made a campaign promise.
No new taxes or fees.
They now control both chambers of the legislature, so Bragdon knows programs will be slashed and people won't get services they may have gotten last year. He says that grim reality is why he typically starts off all budget meetings with one of his favorite lines.
By the way, we're broke. It's a laugh. It lightens the air and it then allows us to proceed with the nitty-gritty.
But in that meeting with the Manfreds, he didn't use it.
I am pretty tight fiscally. There's no doubt about it.
House lawmakers voted to cut $20 million from programs for the developmentally disabled, like the Manfreds' daughter.
But within the Senate Finance Committee, mental health and developmental disabilities are very high concerns, and we will try our best to get the funds back there.
Kind of good to hear.
That is good to hear. That's good to hear from you. And
yeah, this has been very fruitful. Thank you.
But if Bragdon wants to restore that funding, he knows other programs will lose out. Higher education already took a $45 million hit in the House budget. Bragdon concedes the reduction could mean fewer scholarships for low-income students.
You know, a legitimate concern, something the state has funded. But if I look at that compared to the mental health services and developmental disabilities, that kind of struck me as, okay, there are options for these people, whether it's through family or through work or going to a different college than the expensive one they may want to go to. Whereas the person that needs the mental health services right away, there are not a lot of other options to take care of that.
As Bragdon weighs competing funding priorities, people like child advocate Jackie Cowell are warning that short-term budget cuts could result in larger costs down the road.
You don't fund child care, you're going to have more people on welfare. You don't, you know, which costs the state money. It's very frustrating.
Last year on the campaign trail, it was easy to talk about wasteful spending. But Bragdon admits when he thinks about people who get state services and why they get those services, shrinking the size of government is actually pretty hard to do.
Sitting over there in the corner of my office is a poster made by folks who do alcohol counseling as kind of a proactive preventative measure. And there's some legitimate policy reasons that could be made why doing things on a proactive preventative basis may actually save money and be better for society in the long run.
That's why Bragdon would like to say yes as he meets with lobbyists and constituents over the coming weeks. But he says he knows that isn't going to happen. In Concord, New Hampshire, I'm Dan Gorenstein for Marketplace.
Facebook and Twitter were great for protesters in the Middle East, but social media works both ways, you know.
They also can be a wonderful tool for tyrants.
But first, let's do the numbers. Dow Industrials picked up about a 3%, 45 points today, closed at 12,684. The NASDAQ advanced 0.5%, 15 points, 2843. The S&P 500 climbed 0.4%, 6 points, finished at 1346. Financial firms couldn't manage to cash in, though Citigroup threw off more than 2.3% today after a reverse 1-for-10 stock split. Bank of America tossed out 1%. Goldman Sachs forfeited about 0.6% today. Price of crude was back up today, as I mentioned, after last week's rout, and so were oil stocks. Marathon Oil pumped up more than 5% today. Chevron added more than 1%. ExxonMobil took on about 0.5%. Bonds fell slightly. The yield on the 10-year T-note inched up to 3.15%. That's inched up to 3.15%. You're listening to Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Manta, connecting millions of small business owners with new customers every day on the web at manta.com. By Ally Bank, offering sleeping money alerts to notify customers when their money could be doing more. Learn more at allybank.com. And by Indiana University's Kelley School of Business, providing a personalized approach to career advancement. Learn more at kellei.iu.edu. Marketplace covers the world of economics. Are you ready for some Freakonomics? We're partnering with the team that writes about the hidden side of everything for a regular Marketplace Freakonomics story, podcast, and more. Just go to FreakonomicsRadio.com.
From the Marketplace Datebook, here's a look at events for Tuesday. The Banking, Housing, and Urban Affairs Committee will hold a hearing to review the final report of the Financial Crisis Inquiry Commission. FCIC Chair Phil Angelides will testify. Google kicks off its annual two-day developers conference in San Francisco. And on this day in 1994, Nelson Mandela became South Africa's first black president. I'm Millie Jefferson.
This is Marketplace from APM American Public Media. I'm Kai Rizdahl. The University of California could be hit with as much as $1 billion in cuts as the state tries to close its gaping budget hole. One idea to help keep the University of California system afloat is to let its different campuses charge different rates. At the moment, you pay the same wherever you go, but now maybe the biggies like Berkeley and UCLA might cost more than, say, UC Merced. A similar idea is being floated in New York, not without its critics. From the Marketplace Education Desk at WYPR, Amy Scott reports.
A University of California commission rejected the idea of different tuition for different campuses last year. But with the prospect of even more cuts to the system, the idea has resurfaced.
The first instinct is always to pass as much of the grief as possible along to parents and families.
Patrick Callen is president of the National Center for Public Policy in Higher Education. He questions whether a student's wealth should decide which campus he or she attends. UC is also accepting more out-of-state students who pay higher tuition.
I think that's a fundamental issue of educational policy that we have to decide. You know, do we want to make our most prestigious campuses less affordable to those who can't afford to pay a premium charge?
The UC system has already raised tuition 8% across the board for next year. Nathan Brostrom is Executive Vice President of Business Operations at the University of California. He says increases in financial aid have offset a lot of the pain.
Even while we've had these large tuition increases, the number of low-income students on our campuses has actually grown. And, you know, a campus like Berkeley or UCLA has more Pell Grant recipients than the entire Ivy League combined.
In states like Wisconsin and Texas, flagship campuses have long charged more than others in the same university. New York Governor Andrew Cuomo recently came out in support of such a system in his state. But Patrick Callen cautions the whole country has been going backwards on college affordability. I'm Amy Scott for Marketplace.
Here's today's business story inspired by a quote from Shakespeare. "What's in a name?" the line goes. "That which we call a rose," the bard said. "But if you're Apple, the name is apparently worth $153 billion. The consumer research firm Millward Brown is out with its annual report in which it lists the top 100 most valuable brands. And on top this year is everybody's favorite iPad maker. It edged out Google for the number one spot. But here's the thing. Apple's great and all, but $153 billion just for the brand? We sent Stacey Vanek Smith off to take a look at how much value a brand can really have, and then how the heck you measure it.
Apple earned roughly $65 billion last year, but its brand is worth more than twice that, according to Millward Brown's annual calculation. The company's Mario Simon explains.
So we look at the earnings of a company, and then we ask how much of those earnings can be attributed to the brand. And then we use a multiple to actually make that into a brand value of Apple in the long run.
Millward Brown does that by asking buyers how much the brand factored into their buy.
Versus other drivers of the purchase choice, such as price and location, recommendation, and so forth and so on.
Which still sounds a little nebulous. I put that to brand consultant Rob Frankel.
It's a lot nebulous. This is one of the struggles that business has with determining what their brand and brand strategy should be.
That's because brands have real value. Andrew Zolli is curator of innovation network PopTech. He says a strong brand is what lets a company charge more for what it makes and stand out in a sea of competition.
Someone famously said of Coca-Cola that if you burnt down every one of their factories, they'd be back in business in a quarter. If you knocked everybody on Earth over the head and gave them amnesia, they go out of business in a quarter. And the reason for that is that their brand really exists in all of our minds.
And as the economy becomes more global, companies are having to work harder to stay on our minds, and brands are becoming even more crucial. In New York, I'm Stacey Vanek Smith for Marketplace.
There's a link to that full report. You can see the top 100 rankings all for yourself. It's on our website, marketplace.org. And a correction now from last Friday at our story about a new kind of salt PepsiCo is using on its snacks. It's not that the new stuff is any better for you, as we said at one point. You just need less of it to taste the same saltiness. Reports out of Syria the past couple of days are pretty grim. The government's using snipers and tanks to put down protests all over the country. Something more than 600 people are said to have been killed. It's virtually certain the regime is using less deadly measures as well. Social networks like Facebook and Twitter helped bring disaffected citizens together all over the Middle East. But a lot of Silicon Valley firms have also had a hand in propping up autocrats and censoring the internet and keeping tabs on thousands of activists. Marketplace's Steve Henn reports.
John Palfrey at Harvard's Berkman Center for Internet and Society says it's obvious that social networks and mobile phones played a huge role in the Arab Spring. But
they also can be a wonderful tool for tyrants.
Digital surveillance and online censorship is a booming business in the Middle East. Many Western firms are rushing to cash in. Just 10 days after Hosni Mubarak stepped down in Egypt, as tanks were rolling into Bahrain's capital, hundreds of representatives of U.S. and Western tech firms were flocking to the ISS World Conference in Dubai.
ISS stands for Intelligence Support Systems.
Jerry Lucas has organized this event for years. It's kind of a global meet and greet, bringing together Western firms that make surveillance tech and potential customers.
Our attendees, many of them are undercover agents.
So this isn't the kind of conference where a reporter can just wander around collecting cards and asking questions. It's a mix of sales pitches and in-depth training sessions for police, counterterrorism analysts, and agents.
We had over 1,000 registered, but actually only about 830-some showed up.
This year, there was a raft of last-minute cancellations from Egypt, Libya, Tunisia, and Bahrain.
But of course, we had a strong attendance from Saudi Arabia.
Also Pakistan, the United Arab Emirates, and Central Asia. This year's sessions focused on tapping into encrypted cell phone networks or how to do mass geolocation and tracking using mobile phones. And some of the most popular explored the latest techniques for mining intel from social networks. Lucas says these are all legitimate technologies for police work and fighting terrorism. But
can these tools be used to suppress people's rights? Yes.
Facebook and Twitter received lots of credit for helping to spread the revolutions in Egypt and Tunisia. But Silicon Valley's contributions to the Arab Spring are actually much more complicated. Within a half an hour's drive of Facebook's Palo Alto headquarters, there are at least a half a dozen other tech firms whose sales in the Middle East facilitate surveillance or censorship. Driving down Highway 101 from Palo Alto, you'll pass the headquarters of McAfee and Palo Alto Networks. Both sell technology that's widely used in the Middle East to censor the net. You'll pass Polaris, which helps states track their citizens using cell phones. And if you turn left and head out to Milpitas, you'll reach SS8. In security circles, SS8 is kind of infamous for designing software to bug BlackBerries. Tyler Shields is a security consultant at Veracode.
Essentially, a lot of countries in the Middle East and Asia like to monitor all data in and outbound from their borders.
But BlackBerries use their own network, and everything's encrypted. Shield says SS8 designed a workaround, a bug that can be downloaded onto a BlackBerry. And a couple of years ago, the United Arab Emirates pushed that kind of software out onto every BlackBerry in its network. Hundreds of thousands of customers were told it was a necessary patch.
It actually wasn't a patch at all. What it was a spyware-type package.
Shields and others tore the patch apart and found evidence this spyware was made by SS8. SS8 didn't respond to multiple requests to comment, but their executives did travel to Dubai this winter to drum up more business and offer training sessions to officials and agents at the ISS World Conference. In fact, none of the companies mentioned in the story would talk at all. John Palfrey at Harvard's Berkman Center is disappointed, but he's not surprised.
My question to them would be, what's wrong with selling into, say, 170 markets in the world and setting aside 30 markets where you know that there might be a problem with how people use these technologies?
Their answer might be very simple. Money. Saudi Arabia alone is expected to spend up to $90 billion on security and surveillance technologies in the next 6 years. In Silicon Valley, I'm Steve Henn for Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Progressive Insurance with Snapshot, a program in which rates are determined by the driving habits of policyholders. Learn more at progressive.com. By CSX, transporting 2 billion pounds of goods to market by train and working to help move the economy forward. CSX, how tomorrow moves. And by Putnam Investments. You can ask your financial advisor about Putnam 529 for America or visit putnam.com/529. Additional support from the University of Southern California's Marshall School of Business.
This final note today, a moment in our collective cultural history. 50 years ago today, the then chairman of the FCC, the Federal Communications Commission, a guy named Newton Minow, gave a speech about television. When it's good, he said, there is nothing better. When it's bad, though, television becomes a vast wasteland, the phrase by which the speech has been known ever since. Among the television types not thrilled by Minow's speech was Sherwood Schwartz, the guy who created Gilligan's Island. Here's Newton Minow from an interview not too long ago with KPCC.
I love that. He wrote to me, and he said he was insulted by the speech. And then he named the boat after me, the SS Minow.
So now you know. The Minow would be lost, right? Everybody knows that song. That's Marketplace from APM American Public Media on this Monday. Today, the Dow picked up about 45 points, a third percent. The NASDAQ advanced 15 points, a half percent. The S&P 500 climbed 6 points, 0.4%. Our producers include Avishai Artsy, Millie Jefferson, Megan Larson, and Fiona Ng. You can tune in tomorrow to the Marketplace Morning Report for the latest in business and economic news. And coming up next time back here, along the lines of, if a tree falls in a forest, can you get a traffic ticket if nobody sees the violation? In Britain, oh yes, you can.
I don't think people like the idea of vehicles driving around with a camera recording them.
Oh no, we don't. I'm Kai Rizdahl. Hope you can join us for that tomorrow. This is APM, American Public Media.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky, too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.